This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, this is Cindy, and this is the New York Times News Hour for Tuesday, May 14th, 2024. Our first article of the day is Michael Cohen, Key to Trump Case Tells Jurors of Seedy Hush Money Plot. Donald J. Trump's former bulldog told jurors about his work, threatening enemies, cleaning up problems, and burying embarrassing stories. This article is by Ben Protas, Jonah Abramowitz, and Maggie Haberman. Michael D. Cohen, the do-anything fixer who once boasted of burying Donald J. Trump's secrets and spreading his lies, took the stand at the former president's criminal trial in Manhattan on Monday and exposed those machinations to the jury and the world. Narrating the prosecution's case in tell-all detail, Mr. Cohen testified that Mr. Trump in 2016 had personally directed him to pay off a porn star and had approved a dubious reimbursement plan. Just do it, the former fixer recalled Mr. Trump saying about the hush money payment to the porn star Stormy Daniels. After Mr. Trump had won the White House, Mr. Cohen demanded his money back, he said, and met with Mr. Trump, who approved monthly reimbursements. Then the president-elect changed the subject to his new job, saying, "This is going to be one heck of a ride in D.C." Over nearly 5 hours of testimony, Mr. Cohen painted a damning portrait of his relationship with Mr. Trump, decoded their shady vernacular, and spotlighted the conduct at the center of the first criminal trial of an American president. The silencing of women who had stories of sex with Mr. Trump to tell and to sell. Mr. Cohen's star turn marked the climax of the prosecutor's case as they formally introduced the jury to a witness who has loomed over the trial and could trigger the former president's downfall. He brought the case's architecture into focus, offering firsthand corroboration of what jurors have heard from other witnesses. He also wove a sprawling cast of characters into a single narrative, saying that Mr. Trump, bent on winning the presidency, had orchestrated the cover-up of scandalous stories. Mr. Cohen recalled playing an intimate role in concealing or spinning away the stories that could have torpedoed Mr. Trump's 2016 presidential campaign. None was bigger than when Ms. Daniels shopped her account of a sexual liaison with Mr. Trump, which Mr. Cohen said posed a catastrophic threat. "Total disaster," Mr. Cohen quoted Mr. Trump saying. "Women will hate me." As jurors jotted copious notes, Mr. Cohen said that Mr. Trump did not confirm if Ms. Daniels' story was true, but acknowledged knowing her and called her a beautiful woman. And when Mr. Cohen was unable to quash the story promptly, Mr. Trump blamed him. "I thought you had this under control," Mr. Cohen recalled Mr. Trump saying, drawing a scoff and a laugh from the defendant. In a crucial passage of testimony, Mr. Cohen directly tied Mr. Trump to the hush money deal that kept Ms. Daniels quiet. Mr. Trump, he said, initially conveyed a general instruction, "Just take care of it." Mr. Cohen ultimately did, paying $130,000 to Ms. Daniels, silencing her in the campaign's critical waning days. Once Mr. Trump was in the White House, he reimbursed Mr. Cohen and, according to prosecutors, adopted a plan to falsify records that disguised the repayment as ordinary legal expenses. The prosecutors, who are expected to conclude their case this week, charged the former president with 34 felony counts of falsifying business records, 11 checks, 11 invoices, and 12 entries in Mr. Trump's ledger, none of which reflected the true nature of the reimbursement. On Tuesday, Mr. Cohen will return to the stand and is likely to testify about an encounter with Mr. Trump in the Oval Office, where prosecutors say the two men confirmed the plan to disguise the payments. Soon afterward, Mr. Cohen began to receive the checks. On the stand Monday, Mr. Cohen recounted how he had conspired with Mr. Trump and the longtime publisher of the National Enquirer, David Pecker, to protect the campaign. They plotted, Mr. Cohen said, to promote flattering stories and suppress damaging ones through so-called catch-and-kill deals, the tabloid practice of buying the rights to a story and withholding it. One woman, Karen McDougal, a former Playboy model, accepted $150,000 from the Inquirer to keep quiet about her story of an affair with Mr. Trump, a deal Mr. Cohen helped arrange. Mr. Cohen's loyalty disintegrated in 2018 as federal authorities scrutinized his involvement in the hush money deals, and Mr. Trump shunned them. But until then, Mr. Cohen told jurors, he adopted a take-no-prisoners approach to Mr. Trump's dirty work, bullying enemies with single-minded servitude. "The only thing that was on my mind was to accomplish the task to make him happy," he recalled. He explained that he had reported his moves to Mr. Trump directly, seeking approval from the man he called boss. Mr. Cohen's testimony brought the men face-to-face again on Monday, and only in New York collision of spotlight-seeking showmen, bombastic personalities, expert in operating the twin engines that propel the city, media and money. Though hailing from different worlds, Mr. Trump, a real estate scion, Mr. Cohen, the child of a Holocaust survivor. They were creatures of the same ecosystem, sharing a gritty argot and tough guy personas that belied fragile egos. Mr. Trump bestowed a sense of importance on Mr. Cohen, allowing his hangdog fixer to bask in reflected glory. In return, Mr. Cohen has said, he would bully and cajole Mr. Trump's enemies, both real and perceived, throwing tantrums and deploying profanity as punctuation. He also became something of an alter ego to his fame-hungry boss. Mr. Cohen learned from him, imitated him, and even had Mr. Trump's voluminous list of contacts synced into his phone for ease, he explained from the stand Monday. But Mr. Trump steered clear of email, Mr. Cohen noted, out of fear he would create a paper trail for prosecutors. Mr. Cohen said that the boss knew too many people who have gone down as a direct result of having emails. For weeks leading up to the testimony, prosecutors had inured the jury to Mr. Cohen's outsized personality as they elicited testimony from witnesses who had little love for the former fixer. That move was designed to neutralize the defense's attack on Mr. Cohen as a liar motivated by a deep-seated desire for revenge. He is also, as the defense is fond of noting, a felon. In 2018, Mr. Cohen pleaded guilty to federal crimes, some related to the hush money payment. Prosecutors are offering Mr. Cohen nothing, unlike a traditional cooperating witness who trades testimony for leniency. He has already spent more than a year in federal prison. Since then, he has cast himself as an anti-Trump crusader, dedicating two books, a podcast, and numerous television appearances to seeking what he once called a way to right some of the many wrongs I committed at his behest. On Monday, Mr. Cohen seized the moment, delivering a steady performance that could offer him a measure of public redemption and personal revenge. But next, the defense will cross-examine him, and it could be brutal. Mr. Trump's lawyers are expected to seize on his credibility or, as they see it, his lack of it. Mr. Trump, who faces probation or as long as 4 years in prison, has cast himself as a victim of prosecutorial overreach. He has attacked the district attorney who brought the case, Alvin L. Bragg, who watched Mr. Cohen's testimony from the courtroom on Monday. And even as the judge has imposed a gag order that prevents Mr. Trump from attacking Mr. Cohen and other witnesses, the former president has summoned political allies to the courthouse to do his bidding for him. On Monday, he was traveling with an even deeper entourage of Republican officials than normal, including two United States senators, J.D. Vance and Tommy Tuberville, a congresswoman, Nicole Malliotakis of Staten Island, and two state attorneys general. He also had his son, Eric Trump, who sat two rows behind his father, glaring as Mr. Cohen and posting social media at Mr. Cohen and posting social media attacks. Mr. Cohen's story on the stand included no heroes, and the prosecution did not sugarcoat it. Even Mr. Cohen appeared upset at one point. He shook his head and darted his eyes as prosecutors played a surreptitious recording he had made of a conversation with Mr. Trump about the hush money deal with Ms. McDougal. Mr. Cohen hammered home the recording's significance, translating veiled messages to an apparently rapt jury. On the recording, Mr. Cohen and Mr. Trump discussed how to repay their friend David, a reference to Mr. Pecker. Mr. Cohen also revealed more private conversations, recalling that Mr. Trump had remarked how really beautiful Ms. McDougal was. When Mr. Cohen warned that she was poised to go public, he said Mr. Trump told him to make sure it doesn't get released. The bargain with Ms. Daniels, hashed out in the campaign's final month, was less smooth. Mr. Pecker refused to pay her, putting the onus on Mr. Trump, and therefore Mr. Cohen. When Mr. Trump was slow to decide, hoping the threat would subside after Election Day, Mr. Cohen said that he used every imaginable excuse to stall Ms. Daniels' lawyer, even the holiest of Jewish holidays, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. "I was following directions," Mr. Cohen explained. But Ms. Daniels became impatient and threatened to walk away, prompting Mr. Cohen to pay out of his own pocket. Mr. Cohen said he told Mr. Trump immediately, once he closed the deal, an assertion backed up by phone records. "I was doing everything that I could and more in order to protect my boss," Mr. Cohen told the jury, "which was something I had done for a long time." It paid off. Mr. Trump won the election a few days later. Mr. Cohen lost his patience when Mr. Trump did not award him a job in Washington and gave him what he felt was an insultingly small bonus. He conveyed his anger to the Trump Organization's chief financial officer, Alan H. Weiselberg, who promised that Mr. Trump would boost the bonus and reimburse him for the hush money. Mr. Weiselberg drafted a plan, memorialized in notes that prosecutors displayed in the courtroom, and then Mr. Cohen testified. Mr. Trump blessed it. "Did he show this document to Mr. Trump?" a prosecutor, Susan Hoffinger, asked. "He did," Mr. Cohen said. "He approved it." Our next article. On Instagram, a jewelry ad draws solicitations for sex with a 5-year-old. Advertisers of merchandise for young girls find that adult men can become their unintended audience. In a test ad, convicted sex offenders inquired about a child model. This article is written by Michael H. Keller and Jennifer Valentino DeVries. They have been investigating the dark side of social media, including the online exploitation of children. When a children's jewelry maker began advertising on Instagram, she promoted photos of a 5-year-old girl wearing a sparkly charm to users interested in parenting, children, ballet, and other topics identified by Meta as appealing mostly to women. But when the merchant got the automated results of her ad campaign from Instagram, the opposite had happened. The ads had gone almost entirely to adult men. Perplexed and concerned, the merchant contacted the New York Times, which in recent years has published multiple articles about the abuse of children on social media platforms. In February, the Times investigated Instagram accounts run by parents for their young daughters and the dark underworld of men who have sexualized interactions with those accounts. With the photos from the jewelry ads in hand, the Times set out to understand why they attracted an unwanted audience. Test ads run by the Times using the same photos with no text not only replicated the merchant's experience, they drew the attention of convicted sex offenders and other men whose accounts indicated a sexual interest in children or who wrote sexual messages. The Times opened two Instagram accounts and promoted posts showing the 5-year-old girl, her face turned away from the camera, wearing a tank top and the charm. Separate posts showed the clothing and jewelry without the child model or with a black box concealing her. All of the paid ads were promoted to people interested in topics like childhood, dance, and cheerleading, with Meta's audience tools estimated as predominantly women. Aside from reaching a surprisingly large proportion of men, the ads got direct responses from dozens of Instagram users, including phone calls from two accused sex offenders, offers to pay the child for sexual acts, and professions of love. The results suggest that the platform's algorithms play an important role in directing men to photos of children. And they echo concerns about the prevalence of men who use Instagram to follow and contact minors, including those who have been arrested for using social media to solicit children for sex. On Wednesday, New Mexico's Attorney General, Raul Torres, announced the arrest of three men who were caught in a sting operation trying to arrange sex with underage girls on Facebook, calling it Operation Metaphile. Mr. Torres said Meta's algorithms had played a key role in directing these men to the decoy profiles created by law enforcement. We could set up a brand new undercover account, present it as an underage child on that platform, and likely within a matter of minutes, if not days, that child would be inundated with sexually explicit material, he said, emphasizing the real-world harm that can be caused by online platforms. The investigation by the Times in February found that thousands of parent-run Instagram accounts attracted sexualized comments and messages from adult men. While some parents described the attention as a way to increase their daughters' followers, others complained of spending hours blocking users and said they did not understand how the men had found the accounts. An analysis of the users who interacted with the ads posted by the Times found an overlap between those two worlds. About 36 of the men followed child influencer accounts that were run by parents and were previously studied by the Times. One followed 140. In addition, nearly 100 of the men followed accounts featuring or advertising adult pornography, which is barred under Instagram's rules. Danny Lever, a spokeswoman for Meta, dismissed the Times ad tests as a manufactured experience that failed to account for the many factors that contribute to who ultimately sees an ad, and suggested that it was flawed and unsound to draw conclusions from limited data. When asked about the arrests in New Mexico, Meta said in a statement that child exploitation is a horrific crime, and we've spent years building technology to combat it. The company described its efforts as an ongoing fight against determined criminals. The men engage. Researchers and former employees who worked with algorithms at Meta, which owns Instagram and Facebook, said that image classification tools probably deserved some blame. The tools compare new images with existing ones on the platform and identify users who previously showed interest in them, said Dean Eccles, a former Facebook data scientist who studied its algorithms and is now a professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Test accounts set up last year by the Wall Street Journal found that Instagram's recommendation algorithm served sexualized photos of children and adults to accounts that followed only young gymnasts, cheerleaders, and other children. Although Meta's ad system is not exactly the same as that recommendation system, there are huge similarities between the models, Dr. Eccles said. Former Meta employees familiar with its recommendation and ad delivery systems said that safety teams tried to spot harmful ads, like those promoting scams or illegal drugs, but it was more difficult to identify benign ads that were delivered to inappropriate and potentially harmful audiences. Meta allows advertisers to target certain audiences by topic, and though the Times chose topics that the company estimated were dominated by women, the ads were shown on average to men about 80% of the time, according to a Times analysis of Instagram's audience data. In one group of tests, photos showing the child went to men 95% of the time on average, while photos of the items alone went to men 64% of the time. Piotr Sapiezinski, a research scientist at Northeastern University who specializes in testing online algorithms, said advertisers competed with one another to reach women because they dominate U.S. consumer spending. As a result, Dr. Sapiezinski said, the algorithm probably focused on highly interested, easier-to-reach men who had interacted with similar content. The men engage, he said. The machine is doing exactly what you want it to do. Meta, in a statement, acknowledged the competitive ad environment for female viewers and said, the low quality of the Times ads from new accounts, with images but no text or explanation, contributed to their being delivered to more men. In addition, Meta said, its audience insights data only shows an estimate of who is potentially eligible to see an ad, not a guaranteed audience. Dr. Sapiezinski said, even if the system designed the test ads as low quality, that did not explain why those featuring children went to more men than those without children. Hey, babe. A few hours after the first ad was posted, one of the Times test accounts received a message and a phone call from a man arrested in 2015 in Oklahoma after allegedly using Facebook to try to arrange group sex with girls ages 12 and 14. Hey, babe, another man wrote. He had been arrested in 2020 after contacting a 14-year-old girl in upstate New York over Snapchat and offering to pick her up for sex. Charges against him were dismissed after a court found him mentally incompetent. A third man in Tennessee, who liked one of the photos, had four convictions for child sex crimes, including sex with a child in 1999, sharing a photo on Facebook in 2018 of a 3 to 5 year old being anally or vaginally penetrated, and using Instagram in 2020 to solicit nude photos from a 12-year-old girl he called his sex slave. Instagram's rules ban 12-year-olds. A fourth man, whom the Times was unable to identify, offered to pay for sexual acts with the girl in the photograph. The Times reached out via Instagram chat to anyone who had engaged with the ads and explained that they were tests of the platform's algorithm being run by journalists. The man in New York continued to send messages inquiring about the girl, asking if she was in her bedroom and if she wanted to have sex. He also tried to call her multiple times through the app. In total, the Times identified four convicted sex offenders who had messaged the accounts, liked the photos, or left comments on them. Their Instagram accounts used real names and pictures, or were linked to Facebook accounts that did. Convictions were found by matching that information with sex offender databases in other public records. Five other men, including one who posted a video on Instagram of a girl known to be a victim of child sexual abuse, according to the Canadian Center for Child Protection, have arrest records involving crimes against children. Those men whose court records the Times was able to review either pleaded guilty to a lesser charge or were deemed mentally unfit to stand trial. Instagram's rules prohibit convicted sex offenders from holding accounts, and the Times used Meta's tool to report the men. The accounts remained online for about a week until the Times flagged them to a company spokesman. Asked about the accounts, Ms. Lover said, "We prohibit convicted sex offenders from having a presence on our platforms and have removed the accounts reported to us." One of the men who was convicted in New York of sexually assaulting a 4-year-old girl falls under a state law known as e-stop. That requires sex offenders to register their email address. Every week, the state shares the addresses with technology companies, including Meta. Ms. Lover did not address how the company uses this information or how the man was able to create an Instagram account. Some of the men said they responded to the ad out of concern. One man, who was on parole after spending 46 years in prison in California for murdering his wife, said he was surprised to come across a 5-year-old girl in his feed, which predominantly shows photos of scantily clad or nude adults. "I got no problem looking at naked women, especially after 46 years in prison," he wrote. But he continued, "My attitude about people that engage in child porn or touching a child is pretty simple. Don't do it." The men's engagement with the ads did not surprise some small business owners interviewed by the Times. Morgan Kuntz, a founder of Bella and Omi, a children's clothing business in West Virginia that promotes itself on social media, said the company received inappropriate, almost pedophile-type, perverted comments from men when they started advertising on Facebook in 2021. "It made our models uncomfortable, and it made us uncomfortable, she said. When the company expanded to Instagram, she and her fellow owner, Erica Barrios, decided to avoid the problem by targeting only women, even though fathers and grandfathers are among their regular customers. Lindsay Rouse, who owns Tight Spot Dancewear Center in Pennsylvania, also restricts her ads to women. "When she did not exclude men," she said, "they made up as much as 75% of her audience, and few bought her products. Separately, she limits how often she shares photos of child models in her non-advertising posts because they often attract men," she said. "I don't know how people find it," she said. "I would love to just block all guys." Other business owners expressed similar confusion about how their ads were distributed. Since January, the Utah-based children's clothing company, Young Days, has seen more than a doubling of the share of men in its ads reach, with no major changes in its targeting criteria, according to Brian Bergman, who oversees e-commerce. "The shift towards men has hurt sales," he said, "and the company has since focused on reaching women. It's not a lucrative business for us, but the algorithm keeps pushing us towards men," he said. Okay, moving on to our next article. Trump leads in 5 key states as young and non-white voters express discontent with Biden. A new set of Times Siena polls, including one with the Philadelphia Inquirer, reveal an erosion of support for the president among young and non-white voters upset about the economy and Gaza. This article is written by Nate Cohn. Donald J. Trump leads President Biden in 5 crucial battleground states, a new set of polls shows, as a yearning for change and discontent over the economy and the war in Gaza among young, Black, and Hispanic voters threatened to unravel the president's Democratic coalition. The surveys by the New York Times, Siena College, and the Philadelphia Inquirer found that Mr. Trump was ahead among registered voters in a head-to-head matchup against Mr. Biden in 5 of 6 key states, Michigan, Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, and Pennsylvania. Mr. Biden led among registered voters in only one battleground state, Wisconsin. The race was closer among likely voters. Mr. Trump led in 5 states as well, but Mr. Biden edged ahead in Michigan while trailing only narrowly in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. While Mr. Biden won all 6 of those states in 2020, victories in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin would be enough for him to win re-election, provided he won everywhere else he did 4 years ago. The results were similar in hypothetical matchup that included minor party candidates and the independent candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who won an average of 10% of the vote across the six states and drew roughly equally from the two major party candidates. The findings are mostly unchanged since the last series of Times-Siena polls in battleground states in November. Since then, the stock market has gained 25%, Mr. Trump's criminal trial in Manhattan has started, and the Biden campaign has unleashed tens of millions of dollars in advertisements across the battleground states. The polls offer little indication that any of these developments have helped Mr. Biden, hurt Mr. Trump, or quelled the electorate's discontent. Instead, the surveys show that the cost of living, immigration, Israel's war in Gaza, and a desire for change continue to be a drag on the president's standing. While Mr. Biden benefited from a burst of momentum in the wake of his State of the Union address in March, he continues to trail in the average of national and battleground state polls. The findings reveal widespread dissatisfaction with the state of the country and serious doubt about Mr. Biden's ability to deliver major improvements to American life. A majority of voters still desire the return to normalcy promised by Mr. Biden in the last campaign, but voters in battleground states remain particularly anxious, unsettled, and itching for change. Nearly 70% of voters say that the country's political and economic systems need major changes or even to be torn down entirely. Only a sliver of Mr. Biden's supporters, just 13%, believe that the president would bring major changes in his second term, while even many of those who dislike Mr. Trump grudgingly acknowledge that he would shake up an unsatisfying status quo. The sense that Mr. Biden would do little to improve the nation's fortunes has helped erode his standing among young Black and Hispanic voters, who usually represent the foundation of any Democratic path to the presidency. The Times-Siena polls found that the three groups wanted fundamental changes to American society, not just a return to normalcy, and few believed that Mr. Biden would make even minor changes that would be good for the country. Mr. Trump and Mr. Biden are essentially tied among 18 to 29-year-olds and Hispanic voters, even though each group gave Mr. Biden more than 60% of their vote in 2020. Mr. Trump also wins more than 20% of Black voters, a tally that would be the highest level of Black support for any Republican presidential candidate since the enactment of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The polls suggest that Mr. Trump's strength among young and non-white voters has at least temporarily upended the electoral map, with Mr. Trump surging to a significant lead in Arizona, Georgia, and Nevada, relatively diverse Sun Belt states where Black and Hispanic voters propelled Mr. Biden to signature victories in the 2020 election. Mr. Biden, nonetheless, remains within striking distance. He has maintained most of his support among older and white voters, who are much less likely to demand fundamental changes to the system and far likelier to say that democracy is the most important issue for their vote. As a result, Mr. Biden is more competitive in the three relatively white northern swing states, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. The economy and the cost of living, however, remain the most important issues for one quarter of voters, and a significant drag on Mr. Biden's prospects. More than half of voters still believe that the economy is poor, down merely a single percentage point since November, despite cooling inflation, an end to rate hikes, and significant stock market gains. Nearly 40% of Mr. Trump's supporters said that the economy or the cost of living was the most important issue in the election, among them Jennifer Wright, a registered nurse in Sterling Heights, Michigan. She supported Mr. Trump in 2016 and 2020, and to her, the election comes down to one question: who is the best candidate who is going to help me be in financial situation to retire? Even me, as a registered nurse, I'm buying Kroger brand or store brand. I'm not buying Jif. We've all had to cut back, she said. The Biden administration's insistence that the economy is faring well has fallen flat for many voters, including Jacob Sprague, 32, who works as a systems engineer in Reno, Nevada. He says that he voted for Mr. Biden in 2020, but will not be doing so this time. It is concerning to me when I keep seeing press come out of the White House where they keep saying the economy is good, Mr. Sprague said. That's really weird because I'm paying more on taxes and more on groceries and more on housing and more on fuel, so that doesn't feel good. With less than 6 months to go until the election, there is still time for an improving economy to lift Mr. Biden's standing. Historically, polls at this early stage have not been necessarily indicative of the outcome, and Mr. Trump's breakthrough among traditionally Democratic young, Black, and Hispanic voters may not rest on a solid foundation. His strength is concentrated among irregular, disengaged voters who do not pay close attention to politics and may not yet be tuned into the race. They may be prone to shift their views as the race gets underway. In a finding that will frustrate Democrats, even as it presents opportunity for Mr. Biden, nearly 20% of voters blame him more than they do Trump for the Supreme Court's decision in 2022 to overturn Roe v. Wade. They may be the kind of voters that the Biden campaign hopes to persuade as the campaign heats up. The polls showed that abortion loomed as one of Mr. Trump's biggest vulnerabilities. On average, 64% of voters in battleground states said that abortion should be always or mostly legal, including 44% of Mr. Trump's own supporters. In recent weeks, the Biden campaign has sought to emphasize Mr. Trump's support for the Supreme Court justices who overturned Roe v. Wade. For now, though, voters preferred Mr. Biden over Mr. Trump to handle the issue of abortion by 11 points, 49% to 38%. A bigger challenge for Mr. Biden than disengaged voters may ultimately be the disaffected and the disillusioned, those who desire fundamental changes to American society, or who believe that the political and economic systems need to be torn down altogether. Not long ago, these anti-system voters might have been reliably Democratic, but Mr. Trump's anti-establishment populist brand of conservatism has flipped the usual political dynamic. 70% of voters believe that Mr. Trump will either bring major changes to the political or economic system, or tear down the systems altogether, compared with 24% who expect the same from Mr. Biden. And while many voters express deep reservations about Mr. Trump personally, 43% of voters believe that he will bring good changes to the country, compared with 35% who think the changes will be bad. Mr. Trump fares especially well among those who believe that the political and economic systems ought to be torn down, a group that represents about 15% of registered voters. He leads among these anti-system voters by 32%, or 32 points, and the tear-it-down voters are especially likely to have defected from the president. In contrast, Mr. Biden retains nearly all of his 2020 supporters who believe only minor changes are necessary. These change voters are not necessarily demanding a more ideologically progressive agenda. In the last Time Siena poll of the same states, 11% of registered voters thought that Mr. Biden was not progressive or liberal enough. And while many liberal or progressive voters want major changes, relatively few of those voters are defecting from Mr. Biden. Instead, Mr. Biden's losses are concentrated among moderate and conservative Democratic-leaning voters who nonetheless think that the system needs major changes or to be torn down altogether. Mr. Trump wins just 2% of Mr. Biden's very liberal 2020 voters who think the system at least needs major changes, compared with 16% of those who are moderate or conservative. One exception is Israel's war in Gaza, an issue on which most of Mr. Biden's challenge appears to come from his left. Around 13% of the voters who say they voted for Mr. Biden last time but do not plan to do so again said that his foreign policy or the war in Gaza was the most important issue to their vote. Just 17% of those voters reported sympathizing with Israel over the Palestinians. Gerard Willingham, 30, works as a web administrator and lives in Riverdale, Georgia. He voted for Mr. Biden in 2020, but he plans to vote for a third-party candidate in November because of the president's response to the conflict in Gaza, the issue about which he cares most right now. I think it's made quite a bit of difference in that it made me more heavily than in the past push toward voting for a third party, even if I feel that the candidates almost 100% won't win, Mr. Willingham said. It's starting to reach into my moral conscience, I guess. Mr. Trump's trial in Manhattan on charges that he falsified business records related to a hush money payment to cover up an affair with the adult film star Stormy Daniels was already underway when the polls began in late April. However, the survey offered little indication that the trial had damaged the former president's political fortunes, at least so far. Just 29% of voters in battleground states said that they were paying a lot of attention to Mr. Trump's legal woes, and 35% thought the trial was likely to end in a conviction. Here are the key things to know about how these polls were conducted. We spoke with 4,097 registered voters in Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin from April 28th to May 9th, 2024. Our polls are conducted by telephone using live interviews in both English and Spanish. Nearly 95% of respondents were contacted on a cell phone for this poll. You can see the exact questions that were asked and the order in which they were asked. Voters are selected for the survey from a list of registered voters. The list contains information on the demographic characteristics of every registered voter, allowing us to make sure we reach the right number of voters of each party, race, and region. For this set of polls, we placed nearly 500,000 calls to about 410,000 voters. To further ensure that the results reflect the entire voting population, not just those willing to take a poll, we give more weight to respondents from demographic groups underrepresented among survey respondents, like people with a college degree. You can see more information about the characteristics of our respondents in the weighted sample on the methodology page under composition of the sample. When the states are joined together, the margin of sampling error among registered voters is plus or minus 1.8% percentage points. Each state poll has a margin of error ranging from plus or minus 3.6 points in Pennsylvania to plus or minus 4.6 points in Georgia. Our next article is Secret Hamas Files Show How It Spied on Everyday Palestinians. Hamas monitored political activity, online posts, and apparently even love lives. Palestinians were stuck between an Israeli blockade and a repressive security force. This article is written by Adam Ragson and Ronan Bergman. Adam Ragson reported from Jerusalem and Ronan Bergman from Tel Aviv. The Hamas leader, Yahya Sinwar, has for years overseen a secret police force in Gaza that conducted surveillance on everyday Palestinians and built files on young people, journalists, and those who question the government. According to intelligence officials and a trove of internal documents reviewed by the New York Times, the unit, known as General Security Service, relied on a network of Gaza informants, some of whom reported their own neighbors to the police. People landed in security files for attending protests or publicly criticizing Hamas. In some cases, the records suggest that the authorities followed people to determine if they were carrying on romantic relationships outside marriage. Hamas has long run an oppressive system of governance in Gaza, and many Palestinians there know that security officials watch them closely. But a 62-slide presentation on the activities of the General Security Service, delivered only weeks before the October 7th attack on Israel, reveals the degree to which the largely unknown unit penetrated the lives of Palestinians. The documents show that Hamas leaders, despite claiming to represent the people of Gaza, would not tolerate even a whiff of dissent. Security officials trailed journalists and people they suspected of immoral behavior. Agents got criticism removed from social media and discussed ways to defame political adversaries. Political protests were viewed as threats to be undermined. Everyday Gazans were stuck behind the wall of Israel's crippling blockade and under the thumb and constant watch of a security force. That dilemma continues today with the added threat of Israeli ground troops and airstrikes. We're facing bombardment by the occupation and thuggery by the local authorities, Ihab Fasfous, a journalist in the Gaza Strip who appeared in the files of the General Security Service, said in a phone interview from Gaza. Mr. Fasfous, 51, is labeled in one report as among, quote, the major haters of the Hamas movement. The documents were provided to the Times by officials in Israel's military intelligence directorate who said they had been seized in raids in Gaza. Reporters then interviewed people who were named in the files. Those people recounted key events, confirmed biographical information, and, in Mr. Fasfous' case, described interactions with the authorities that aligned with the secret files. The documents reviewed by the Times include 7 intelligence files ranging from October 2016 to August 2023. The military intelligence directorate said it was aware of files containing information on at least 10,000 Palestinians in Gaza. The General Security Service is formally part of the Hamas political party, but functions like part of the government. One Palestinian individual familiar with the inner workings of Hamas, who spoke on the condition of anonymity because of the sensitivity of the matter, confirmed that the service was one of 3 powerful internal security bodies in Gaza. The others were military intelligence, which typically focuses on Israel, and the Internal Security Service, an arm of the Interior Ministry. Bassem Nayam, a spokesman for Hamas, said the people responsible for the General Security Service were unreachable during the war. With monthly expenses of $120,000 before the war with Israel, the unit comprised 856 people, records show. Of those, more than 160 were paid to spread Hamas propaganda and launch online attacks against opponents at home and abroad. The status of the unit today is unknown because Israel has dealt a significant blow to Hamas's military and governing abilities. The Israeli intelligence authorities believe that Mr. Sinwar directly oversaw the General Security Service, according to 3 Israeli intelligence officials who spoke on the condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to discuss the matter publicly. They said the slideshow was prepared for Mr. Sinwar personally, though they did not say how they knew that. The presentation said that the General Security Service works to protect Hamas's people, property, and information, and to support its leadership decision-making. Some slides focused on the personal security of Hamas leaders. Others discussed ways to stamp out protests, including the We Want to Live demonstrations last year that criticized power shortages and the cost of living. Security officials also tracked operatives from Palestinian Islamic Jihad, an ideologically aligned militant group that often partners with Hamas. Some tactics, like amplifying Hamas's own message, appeared to be routine politicking. In other instances, officials suggested using intelligence to undermine opponents and distort their reputations, though the files were vague about how that was to be done. Undertaking a number of offensive and defensive media campaigns to confuse and influence adversaries by using private and exclusive information, the document read. Security officers stopped Mr. Fasfous on his way to a protest last August, seized his phone, and ordered him to leave, a report says. Mr. Fasfous confirmed that 2 plainclothes officers had approached him. The authorities searched his recent calls and wrote that he was communicating with suspicious people in Israel. We advise that closing in on him is necessary because he's a negative person who was full of hatred and only brings forth the Strip's shortcomings, the document said. The most frustrating thing, Mr. Fasfus said, was that the officers used his phone to send flirtatious messages to a colleague. They wanted to pin a moral violation on me, he said. The report does not include that detail, but does describe ways to deal with Mr. Fasfus. Defame him, the report said. If you're not with them, you become an atheist, an infidel, and a sinner, Mr. Fasfus said. He acknowledged supporting protests and criticizing Hamas online, but said the people he was in touch with in Israel were Palestinians who owned food and clothing companies. He said he helped run their social media accounts. The General Security Service's goals are similar to those of security services in countries like Syria that have used secret units to quell dissent. The files of the General Security Service, though, mention tactics like censorship, intimidation, and surveillance rather than physical violence. This General Security Service is just like the Stasi of East Germany, said Michael Milkstein, a former Israeli military intelligence officer specializing in Palestinian affairs. You always have an eye on the street. Palestinians in Gaza live in fear and hesitate to express dissent, analysts said. There are a lot of people practicing self-censorship, said Mikaimar Abusada, a professor of political science from Gaza City. They just don't want problems with the Hamas government. That view clashes with the most strident comments of Israel's leaders, like President Isaac Herzog, who blamed Gazans for not toppling Hamas before the October 7th attack. There's an entire nation that is responsible, he said. This rhetoric about civilians were not aware, not involved, it's absolutely not true. They could have risen up. The General Security Service, the files show, also tried to enforce a conservative social order. In December 2017, for example, the authorities investigated a tip that a woman was acting immorally with a man who owned a clothing shop. A security report noted that she visited the shop for an hour on one day, then more than 2 hours in the next. The report presented no evidence of wrongdoing, but proposed that relevant parties address the matter. An October 2016 report described young men and women performing unspecified immoral acts at a Palestine Liberation Organization office in Khan Yunis at night. Hamas sees the Palestine Liberation Organization as a compromised entity whose leader too often favors Israeli interests. The report offered no evidence of misdeeds, but recommended summoning a man who claimed to be in possession of videos and pictures. The files also show that Hamas was suspicious of foreign organizations and journalists. When Monique van Hoogstraten, a Dutch reporter, visited a protest encampment along the border with Israel in April 2018, the authorities noted the most banal of details. They noted the make and model of her car and her license plate number. They said she took pictures of children and tried to interview an elderly woman. Ms. van Hoogstraten confirmed the reporting trip in an interview with The Times. The file recommended further reconnaissance on journalists. None of the files reviewed by The Times were dated after the start of the war. But Mr. Fasfus said the government remained interested in him. Early in the war, he said he took images of security forces hitting people who fought over spots in line outside a bakery. The authorities confiscated his camera. Mr. Fasfus complained to a government official in Khan Yunis, who told him to stop reporting and destabilizing the internal front, Mr. Fasfus recalled. I told him I was reporting on the truth, and that the truth won't hurt him. But that fell on deaf ears, he said. We can't have a life here as long as these criminals remain in control. We have time for just a little bit more. Here is an article. A Night to Remember at the Opera, complete with a phantom. About 130 children took part in a sleepover at Rome's Opera House, part of a campaign to make up for a lack of music education by making the theater and the art form more familiar and accessible. This article is written by Elizabeth Povoledo, reporting from Rome. In the pitch-dark auditorium of Rome's Teatro Costanzi, a high-pitched lament floated from the top galleries. Dozens of flashlights snapped on, their beams crisscrossing crazily, seeking the source of the sound. The shafts of light homed in on a special figure, a slim, dark-haired woman dressed in white, moving at a funeral pace and plaintively singing. In the audience, 130-odd children, ages 8 to 10, let loose squeals, some gasps, and one, "It's not real." Several called out, "Emma, Emma." The children had just been told that Costanzi, the capital's opera house, had a resident phantom. No, not that one. This was said to be the spirit of Emma Corelli, an Italian soprano who managed the theater a century ago and loved it so much that she was loath to leave it, even in death. The theater is a place where strange things happen, where what is impossible becomes possible, Francesco Giambroni, the Costanzi's general manager, told the children Saturday afternoon when they arrived to participate and to get to know the theater sleepover. Music education ranks as a low priority in Italy, the country that invented opera and gave the world some of its greatest composers. Many experts, including Mr. Giambroni, say their country has rested on its considerable laurels rather than cultivate a musical culture that encourages students to learn about their illustrious heritage. With little backing from schools or lawmakers, arts organizations like the Costanzi have concluded that it is up to them to reach out to the young. Mr. Giambroni sought to dispel opera's stuffy image by abandoning the genre's strict dress code. That change, like the sleepover, is part of his effort to make opera, often seen as an elitist, highbrow, and abstruse art form for the initiated, more familiar and accessible, especially to children. And that concludes for now our time, the New York Times NewsHour. This is Cindy from Radio Reading Services of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. Thank you for listening.